Hello, it's Wednesday, the 18th of August. I'm Richard Spur, standing in for Andrew Pearce, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Netflix has revealed the actors cast to play Diana and Charles in the new season of The Crown, as the series moves on to the couple's painful divorce. The UK government is set to scrap the pensions triple lock, but what will that mean for pensioners? Harry and Meghan have blessed us all with a statement in response to news coming out of Afghanistan, Haiti, and the COVID-19 crisis. But first, who is the new leader of the Taliban in Afghanistan? The Taliban is preparing its new government as previously exiled leaders return to seats of power. But who is Abdul Ghani Baradar, the Taliban leader preparing to be president? Daily Mail writer Guy Adams has explored his blood-soaked past, where he's boasted of raging jihad. He joins me now to discuss the situation. I mean, what do we know about this man and whether he will simply continue to rule in the way that the Taliban did with an iron fist in the 1990s?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, of course. And the short answer is that, as with lots of people in Afghanistan, we actually don't know a huge amount. There's no sort of births, marriages and deaths records and whatnot. And this guy's been in hiding for quite a lot of his life. He's been fighting various wars on behalf of the Taliban. And before that, he fought against Soviet troops as a member of the Mujahideen. So he's been a kind of he's been involved in guerrilla wars for most of his life. And by his very nature, that means obviously you keep a reasonably low profile and don't make yourself an easy target. But what we do know about him is actually quite interesting. And for most of the last decade, he's actually been behind bars. He was captured in Pakistan in 2010, and at the time he was effectively the leader of the Taliban, or at least their number two. And from behind bars, quite interestingly, he began advocating, having been a key figure in the Taliban government in the 1990s, who were pretty nasty operators. He began advocating a slightly more conciliatory tone towards the West and presenting him the future of his movement as a sort of slightly more establishment one. And he was therefore released in 2018 at the behest of the United States, and he became the Taliban's, if you like, chief negotiator in the negotiations that led to, in a roundabout way, to the American withdrawal this week.
We know from experience and from their own proclamations that the Taliban is an organization which murders, which rapes, and which is misogynistic. Can we in any way believe their claims that they will continue to value women as members of society and, for example, the education of women?
Well, the leaders might claim that. And the question, of course, is whether their followers go along with that in what is not an organization, the Taliban, like a political organization in this country where you might have some sort of, you know, power structure and an obvious sort of chain of command. But they are definitely talking the talk on that front. And what was quite interesting when I researched Abdul Ghani Baradar yesterday, I learned a little about how the Taliban had started in the first place. And it's worth bearing in mind if you're trying to sort of think about what might happen in Afghanistan next. So what happened was that during the 1980s, obviously the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and there was a rebellion against them by the Mujahideen, of which Mr. Baradar and lots of people were members. When that war came to an end in 1989, Afghanistan descended into a state of pretty much lawlessness, with different parts of the country governed by different warlords. Now, at that time, Baradar actually put down his weapons and he went to live in a madrasa with some allies, including a chap called Mullah Omar, who is his great sort of mentor and friend. He was the leader of the Taliban until his death in 2013. And they essentially decided to sort of study Islam and devote their lives to the faith and whatnot, except that in after a couple of years, they realized that the local warlord in the area of Afghanistan where they were living was actually a pretty nasty piece of work, and that his troops were raping women and boys and were behaving pretty nastily. And so they decided, they held a meeting and said, look, this won't do. This is actually a perversion of Islam. And they then formed the Taliban as their own sort of movement that would do away with those sort of practices. And they began in 2014, the first sort of Taliban uprising only involved 30 troops, and they got rid of the local warlord. Within 2 years, they were actually in charge of the entire country. So they started off as a movement that was in some ways, I think progressive is obviously completely the wrong word, but was less bad than the one they replaced. Obviously, they were then in government for 7 years, and that was a pretty horrific time if you happen to be a woman in Afghanistan. And it was a pretty ugly time for the West, because obviously they gave sanctuary to Osama bin Laden, who then plotted the 2001 terror attacks. Now, the hope, I suppose, of the West is that ever since the fall of the Taliban in 2001, although they've sort of carried on fighting this guerrilla war, you know, times have changed, things have moved on. This was, you know, it's been 20 years, and I think they probably appreciate that in a way, if they don't keep their noses reasonably clean, the West can just come into Afghanistan again and wipe them off the face of the map. Pretty, you know, if they want to remain in government, I think they realise that, first of all, we can't have terror attacks being carried out in the West by organisations that are given sanctuary in Afghanistan. And secondly, they have to at least go through the motions of being more tolerant than they've been in the past, although that's, of course, a very low bar.
Well, obviously, any action by the West would have to overcome an enormous amount of public opinion, both in America and in the UK, against that course of action. Just finally, on
I think you're right about that. I think the public obviously wouldn't like another military action in the West. By the West, except in circumstances where, you know, another 9/11 happened. I mean, if a major cities get bombed by terrorists who are based in Afghanistan, then I think the public opinion would shift pretty quickly on that front. So,
on that point, I agree with you entirely. And you know, God forbid that anything like that were to happen again. But I just wanted to ask you finally on Baradar. I mean, apart from the rather oleaginous attentions, not surprisingly, of Russia, has this individual got any ability, do you think, diplomatically, to discourse in a reasonable way with other nations?
Well, he was involved. He was the leading negotiations with Donald Trump's Afghan peace envoy, a guy called Zalmay Khalilzad. Those peace talks ran from October 2018 until, I think, December. I think I'm right in saying December 2019, and they did end in a peace deal of sorts. So he has had some experience of conducting these negotiations. In fact, after the peace deal was signed in March 2020, he had a 35-minute phone conversation with President Trump himself, and he met with Mike Pompeo. There were photographs of their meeting. So in a slightly gaudy hotel room somewhere in the Middle East. So, I mean, yes, he has some experience of diplomacy. And does seem to have some understanding of how the process works. Although, on the flip side, I don't think he speaks very much English. Obviously, his values are not Western values. I don't think he's going to be sort of advocating elections anytime soon or anything like that. But I think he probably gets it a little more than some of his fighters. And I think he's everyone who knows anything about the guy who has spoken, which is not a huge sort of is not a huge resource of people, but people who do seem to know about him, he's a very cunning and very shrewd man militarily. And in fact, he was the guy who came up with the main Taliban tactic during the occupation, which was not to actually try and fight a battle with Western troops, but simply to organise ambushes using IEDs and rocket-propelled grenades, and then sort of to melt away on motorcycles. He's a pragmatist, and he knows kind of what he needs to. He'll be aware of what he needs to do to maintain a grip on power. And I think probably, as I said earlier, that will involve some sort of attempt to quell the excesses of his organisation. But of course, whether he succeeds in that remains to be seen.
Well, let us hope. Guy, thanks for the time. That was Daily Mail features writer Guy Adams. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at The Spur Show. Harry and Meghan have published a statement on their Archerwell Foundation website addressing the devastation in Afghanistan, where Harry completed two frontline tours. Reception of their statement has, well, shall we say, been a mixed bag, with one description calling it a vague publicity-seeking word salad. Well, royal biographer Angela Levin joins us now to discuss the situation. What was your initial reaction, Angela?
My heart dropped. I thought, how could they be so foolish, so patronising, and so out of contact with ordinary people?
This is a man who, well, has ostensibly, in whatever way, been involved in some sense in Afghanistan, but now seems to talk with rather more authority than you might credit him with.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when I was speaking to Prince Harry for his biography that I was writing, we talked a lot about Afghanistan and his activities there. And he said, you know, it's when he felt most himself. He loved being with all the guys. He loved the fact that he had Christmas Day with the Gurkhas away from the royal family, eating goat that a Gurkha found, he doesn't know how, and washing once a week with a cold shower. I mean, he was very, very keen on it, and he liked all the activities and all that sort of thing. And when he had to come back because his position was found and he was a danger to lots of other people as well as himself, he had almost a breakdown because he felt that that's what he was supposed to do, and he didn't. More recently, quite interestingly, a lot of the guys who were out there with him have criticised him a lot and said he didn't do nearly as much as he's implying. He was mollycoddled and cotton-wooled by his protection officers all the time, and he wasn't even very friendly. So I'm not sure about that, but I would give him the benefit of the doubt and say he was doing his duty, and he was very, very pleased to have done that. But now he sort of slipped in as a sort of extra person behind Meghan, as if they're there to sort of look after us all, and we're all very sort of vulnerable children. It's a combination of that and trying to do a woke alternative royal family, I think. I mean, who is Meghan now to talk about Afghanistan and Hawaii? What does she know about earthquakes? It's just extraordinary, actually, how they latch onto everything. And saying, we're going to support the charities that are working for that. What do they mean by that? Give them money or just ring them up and say, jolly good show?
It is utterly nauseating. And, you know, I saw an interview the other day with a veteran who'd lost both of his legs and said that he felt that that now had been completely in vain, as was the death of his former colleagues. And I said that on this podcast a couple of days ago. And yet this man sitting in Santa Barbara with, you know, that woman fueling the fire of his malice appears to believe that his word can, you know, suddenly calm troubled waters. It is beyond ridiculous, isn't it?
It is, actually, and I think it's also ridiculous if he comes over to the UK with a Netflix camera crew and start talking to various wounded soldiers, physically and psychologically, for his piece of TV on the Invictus Games, which he did, you know, help start up. I think the timing is terrible, and I hope he pulls out of that. But one of the things that made my skin creep was when they said, we feel many layers of pain about it all. It is really, we are speechless, heartbroken, and scared. It's all that we are. You know, who is the we? I don't really want to be told how I feel by somebody who absolutely is not in a position to do that. They pretend they're so kind and helpful, yet you take a look at how they behave with either set of parents and they're really awful.
Can they get any more morally and exploitatively low in their behaviour, this dreadful couple?
Well, I've been saying that for about a year now, and I think, you know, you are more and more astonished. The grandiose approach to life is quite extraordinary, particularly from Meghan, and she does really feel, and I think that it's there in the copy, that she said she hopes, or they said, but it's obviously Meghan, those with global influence to advance humanitarian dialogues should do their best, including the United Nations. Now, she's always talking about global influence for herself. Does she actually think, and she hints when she writes, does she actually think that she's got enough global influence to be there at UN talking about things that she absolutely knows nothing about? I thought that was a sort of cunning way to actually take on more power and more fame and perhaps more money.
I think knowing nothing about things is Meghan Markle's specialist subject. And I just wonder, you know, whether these two will be happy until the Queen is completely destroyed, discredited, and maybe no longer with us. I mean, what is their ultimate goal?
Well, I think it's definitely to destroy the royal family. I think that Meghan was absolutely furious that they didn't leap up and accept all her brand new ideas, which she offered very soon after she arrived. She didn't think she had to settle down. She was raring to go, and I think she was very cross and very upset that they weren't listening to her. Whereas really, you know, she needed to learn the ropes first, and then perhaps they would have listened to some good ideas she might have had. And I think she's very revengeful. We've seen that with her father, who let the Mail have a look at a letter. You know, she doesn't forgive and she doesn't forget. And I think this is her time to get her own back. And I think that's why she called her daughter Lilibet, because the Queen said they can't do things, commercial things, while using their royal titles. You can't use the royal family to make money. And if she calls a Lilibet, and she does a foundation, a Lilibet foundation, which she should do because girls are equal to boys and Archie's already got one, the Queen can't help it. So she'll be sort of tied to all the commercial things that little Lilibet has got the name to do. And I think that that's all part of it. I think it's a big plot. I'm sorry to say that, but I think that that's really the destiny. And certainly to get rid of Prince Charles and also Prince William. I mean, and then Harry will have to become king with Meghan as, well, Meghan will be king really, won't she?
Well, let us hope that never happens. They continue to make me, and I imagine others, physically queasy. Yes. Many thanks to royal biographer Angela Levin there. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at The Spur Show. Chancellor Rishi Sunak is under pressure to axe the pensions triple lock. At the last election, Conservatives pledged to increase the state pension in line with either wage growth, inflation, or by 2.5%, whichever was the highest. But as wages surge, Sunak has hinted that it could be scrapped. Well, I'm joined now by Julian Jessop, Economics Fellow at the Institute of Economic Affairs. What's your view on how this situation is going to pan out?
Well, first of all, like most independent experts, I think that something does need to be done about the pensions triple lock this year at least. That's because the COVID has distorted the benchmark for pay that is used in ways that I think nobody anticipated when the Tory manifesto included the commitment to increase wages and the way increase the state pension the way that you've described. So something has to be done. I don't think it necessarily has to be scrapping the triple lock altogether. I mean, that obviously would be politically controversial, and there are actually some quite decent arguments for keeping the triple lock in the longer term. But I think this year there are some things that you can do that would at least keep to the spirit of the manifesto commitment without costing enormous amounts of money. So, for example, using some measure of underlying pay growth rather than just the single figure for this year. And I think that's probably where we'll end up.
Do you not think that, though, that they should stick to this pledge?
Well, when the pledge was made, nobody was anticipating that the big collapse in wages and the economy in 2020 and then a rebound in 2021. So that huge swing in economic activity and in employment and in wages is something that nobody is really expecting when the triple lock pledge was made. So I think these are sort of the exceptional circumstances that would justify you changing your plans. And it's rather like, in a way, agreeing to meet somebody for a picnic and then subsequently not turning up because it's pouring with rain. So when the circumstances change, sometimes the policy has to change. And I think most people would be sympathetic to the idea that it's not necessarily fair to pay pensioners an across-the-board increase that might be as much as 8 or 9% simply because of these distortions in the way that pay is calculated.
Why are wages going up?
Well, there are lots of distortions here. I mean, it's not as if lots of people are being paid 8% more now than they were a year ago. For a start, this is a sort of average figure over a week. So if people are working longer hours because they're returning to work as the economy reopens, then that will push up the average. There are also some changes in the average type of person who's in work. So a lot of the people who've lost their jobs, unfortunately, have been lower paid. So the people that have been left have tended to be higher paid, and that's boosted the average as well. If you strip out some of these factors, then underlying pay growth is probably only about 2 to 3%, which is probably more like the sorts of numbers most people are familiar with. But the way this sort of average weekly measure is calculated, the numbers at the moment are an awful lot higher.
And just finally, what other pension protections could be put in place if this situation continues?
Well, the number of things you could do in the longer term, I think the idea of indexing pensions to wages is dangerous because that tends to mean that pensions are going to take an ever-increasing share of national income and government spending from year to year. So I think there are alternatives. One would be to focus money on pensioners who are in the worst circumstances. So rather than an across-the-board increase in pension, target the money at people that need it the most. And the second thing is, I think you could tweak the triple lock, maybe make it just a double lock. So it ensured that pensions rise by a minimum, say 2.5 or by inflation, but not necessarily in line with wages, because that is more likely to produce the sort of distortion that we've seen over the last year.
Many thanks for joining us, Julian. That was Economics Fellow at the Institute of Economic Affairs, Julian Jessop. I'm joined now by Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nicol, and he's got all the very latest. Harry Kane, of course, is the name on everyone's lips today.
Yes, will he, won't he? That's the big question. There's 13 days to go till the transfer window closes. He is desperate to get out of Tottenham and move to the champions, Manchester City. Tottenham don't want to sell him. The saga rumbles on. You go back to the end of last season, around April, May, where he basically made it clear that he wanted to leave the club after joining the club as a schoolboy. He scored masses of goals for the club, but they've not won a trophy in the time he's there, and now he's 28. He wants to go and win things, and we're better to do that at the moment than Manchester City with Pep Guardiola. And they won the Premier League title last season. They've won the League Cup 4 years in a row, got to the Champions League final. It's pretty much nailed on that you're going to win trophies there, and so you can see the appeal for Harry Kane. But Tottenham are digging in. They don't want to sell him. He's their best player. He's got 3 years left on his deal. So far, the offer from Manchester City has been £100 million plus £25 million worth of add-ons. That's not enough for Tottenham. They need more than that. They want more than that. And we're in a sort of game of brinksmanship here where, you know, Kane is desperate to get out and Spurs want to keep him. City haven't offered enough money yet, and on it goes. But we are running out of time if it's going to happen in the transfer window. Like I say, 13 days to go. He missed the first game of the season for Tottenham, was left out of the squad entirely, which is completely unheard of. That game, of course, was a 1-0 win against Manchester City, of all teams. Food for thought there, perhaps, for Kane. But they're off in the Europe tonight. They're playing in the Conference League tomorrow night in Portugal, and he's not flown with the squad. Of course, the line from the club is that he will be available for the Premier League on Sunday, but the fact that he's not flown as well, that gives you another insight into perhaps how they want to treat him at the moment, how they want to handle the situation. But really, it's a transfer saga that, until Manchester City offer Tottenham what they want, it will just rumble on and on. And I don't think he's going to get the move unless they stump up the cash.
And you talk about cash just finally. Some of the figures now that these players are transferring for, I mean, is there any sort of glass ceiling, or will it just go up and up and up?
Well, I mean, football transfers, you know, going back to Trevor Francis going for £1 million to Forest back in 1979, I think it was, 1980. Football's always been, there's been mad money around it. And obviously the advent of the Premier League, and now we have these huge TV deals. I think the last one was 5.5 billion. There's an awful lot of money swirling around in football. Of course, because of the last 18 months thing, you know, lots of clubs have had to, you know, adjust their spending in some ways. But as we've seen with PSG, Manchester City, Chelsea, these clubs can afford it. They've got wealthy backers. They don't need to sort of watch their spending. In fact, this is a really quite a sort of good time for them to take advantage of the situation. While, you know, you look at the situation with Real Madrid and Barcelona in Spain, they don't really have any money. There's not much money in lower down in the Premier League. And so they've really got their pick of players, and they've got the money to do it. I think there will naturally be a point where the spending does slow down at some point in the future, because the bubble has to burst at some point. The TV rights can't keep going up, every time that the deal comes up for renewal.
Tim, good to hear from you. That was Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nicol. Netflix has shown off images of the actors Dominic West and Elizabeth Debicki in the roles of Prince Charles and Princess Diana in the new season of The Crown. So, what's going to happen in this series? I'm joined now by TV and radio reporter for the Daily Mail, Eleanor Sharples. What's been the reaction to these castings?
Yeah, so really exciting. Obviously, Josh O'Connor and Emma Corrin did a fantastic job and picked up a number of awards for their portrayals as Charles and Diana in the last series. So, yeah, I think people are really excited. I think particularly with Series 5, you know, we're going into a brand new cast. So, yeah, to have, you know, Dominic West in the role as Charles and Elizabeth Debicki, the Australian actress, as Diana, you know, I think people are excited to see where they can take the roles forward and into, you know, a really tumultuous time for the pair's relationship.
I thought in the last series of The Crown, the portrayal of Diana was just incredible.
Yeah.
It was almost like a facsimile. You forgot it wasn't Diana.
Absolutely. I mean, Emma was fantastic. And I think as well, it was really her breakout role too. And people, you know, she was a household name coming out after that drama and her portrayal in it. So, yeah, I would definitely say Elizabeth has got a lot to big shoes to follow following Emma's performance in The Crown. But, you know, I'm sure she will make it her own role. It's a particular time for everyone that, you know, so many people will remember the breakdown of their marriage, and, you know, the series might tell her death in 1997 as well. So I'm sure she'll do just as a fantastic job. Will no doubt want to bring a very different edge to the role than that Emma Corrin did.
I cancelled my Netflix subscription when they put the price up, but I'm definitely going to renew it now.
I just
wonder, you know, what it's like to have to portray on screen such controversial characters.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt it has been, and probably so difficult when you don't know them personally as well. So you've obviously got to, you know, do a lot of research into their characters and, you know, the portrayal, I guess, that they gave off in the media and stuff at the time. So, yeah, I think it, I can't imagine kind of what research they have to do to get into character. But yeah, no doubt it's a massive job for them.
Can you explain why the quote-unquote getting cosy of Dominic and Lily has gone down in the way that it has?
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. So obviously last year, Dominic West and Lily James, who British actress who has just been in the BBC's The Pursuit of Love. So in October last year, photos emerged of the two of them apparently getting close while they were out in Rome. And they were snapped in photographs in a clinch over lunch and sharing a scooter ride around the city. It all looked very, very cozy. However, you know, Dominic and his wife, Catherine, did come out later and insisting that all was well in their marriage. It's an interesting one, bearing in mind he's playing, you know, Prince Charles and will be portraying, you know, the breakdown of his marriage to Diana. It was quite a scandal at the end of last year, actually, with those photographs.
And just finally, will the final two series of The Crown cover when it comes to the history of the family?
Yes. So while it's not yet known particularly what storylines they're going to follow, obviously the way series four ended, starting at the breakdown of Charles and Diana's marriage. So this is definitely going to look at the breakdown of that marriage even further. I think as well, episodes could deal, you know, with the separation of Prince Andrew from Sarah Ferguson. Maybe the fire at Windsor Castle and also Princess Anne's divorce from Mark Phillips. All of that kind of happened in 1992 as well. So definitely think they could feature. But also, you know, Princess Diana died in 1997 and Margaret and the Queen's mother's death as well in 2002. You know, they could also all feature. So while it's not yet clear, and then Netflix don't like to give too much away, it has previously been said that the final two series will bring the drama into the 21st century. So lots of big events to cover, I think, in the next two series.
I have to admit, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks so
Me
much.
Too, there, can't wait.
That was the TV and radio reporter from the Daily Mail, Eleanor Sharples. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Richard Spur, in for Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have a great evening. Good night.